Let's just pick up. We've got a more intimate table this morning, which is absolutely great, particularly for this subject of art, writing, performance. And we've also got, later on this afternoon, our table of archives. So we've got several people who weren't here yesterday. And so I wondered if you'd like, if we could just go around with a very quick kind of just names and the people who weren't here yesterday, just quickly something about yourselves. And then if we do need or want to move nearer, do, because they arranged the chairs slightly differently this morning, so you can always kind of bring them round or move round if you want to. Should we just do that quickly, kind of start at the back and with Maria or Tony, if you want to come a bit nearer, do. Because there's lots of space around here, and it's kind of be much easier to get round the table. Because otherwise we're going to have to shout. We can move up a little bit because we've already got quite a big space in the middle here.
Mine's
going to be
interesting.
I think we may end up not noticing you. So now we've kind of start again. So Marie, actually, let's just start then. Steve's up at the back there. That's Steve Ball. You weren't here yesterday. But Sue, can you just speak up and say it again?
Jeff Laycock and I head up a database, which is an online archiving service.
I'm Maria Walsh, BA Fine Art Theory Coordinator and one of the conveners of the Subjectivity and Feminisms Research Group at Chelsea.
Mika Percy, artist and working with ICFAR in collaboration on the online presence for this symposium, which I'll talk a little bit more about later.
I'm Michael McMillan, I'm a writer, artist, Q&A, Doctor of Arts at Middlesex University.
I'm Lydiot, I'm a visual artist and I've just been appointed as senior advisor in research and publications at Bergen School of Art in Norway.
I'm Neville White, I'm a postdoctoral research assistant at Central St Martins.
Good morning, I'm Carolyn McCall. Research student at Central
Martins. My name is Christoph Schenk. I'm the Institute for Contemporary Arts Research at the University of the Arts at Zurich.
I'm Sarah Jane Bales and I teach, write about, and make performance. And I'm working with Claire on a live art and performance oral history project.
I'm Claire McDonald. I'm the director of ICFAR. And for the purposes of this paper particularly, I'm also co founder and editor of a journal called Performance Research. Which for many years try to work, if you like, between the space of performance and the space of the page, and that's one of my reasons for pulling this together this morning.
My name's
Michael Windpoller, and I work as an academic researcher at the Institute of Contemporary Arts Research at the University of Free Art, Zurich.
My name is Ólöf Sigurðardóttir, I'm the head of research at the Iceland Academy of the Arts.
My name is Annie Hogan, I'm research professor at Wimbledon College of Art, and I'm a painter and a book artist in his oral history in my own practice. But also at Wimbledon, I'm very involved in an archive, which is a big theatre archive, but also an urban archive.
Paul Caudle, I'm professor at Campbell and Chelsea, and work with Iqbal, with Claire, and I run the FAE research project, Fine Art Digital Environment.
Thank you. It's really good to hear all that again, actually, as well from people that weren't here yesterday, because it just reminds me and brings into the room the particular intersection that we're going to talk about this morning. For obvious reasons of my own, my own background being in performance and in writing, I'm really interested in the intersection of art, writing, and performance. So around the table, we've got work in the sonic, work that works between painting, bookmaking, archiving, documentation. All of those interests suggest to me a very important conversation that we need to have in the kind of international partnership that we're gathering about around the intellectual and creative notions about the intersection of art, writing, and performance. Publishing, publication, the way that's being extended through what I call the way art thinks. But also a pragmatic conversation about things that we might actually do. And some of that might then lead on into the archive session this afternoon. So the way I thought we'd run it this morning, again, is to ask two people today, Anne Lydiat and Kathy Lane, just to give us a kind of short prompt on the work where they come to this subject. And then at a later point, I'll just invite Michael Hiltbrunner from our partner in Zurich to talk a little bit about their approaches to research and publication. And in between, we'll begin to kind of think about ways in which we can respond to the questions that are around our writing performance. But before I kind of go into that any more deeply, I'll just ask Anne to really just to lead off.
Okay, obviously thought about this morning quite a bit and I realised there's not very much time, but I decided to take the text that I'm going to say and obviously talk about drawing from a book called Pilgrimage that was published by a friend of mine, Nikki Coots, who works at Middlesex and the Royal College of Art. And I was invited to work with one of her postgraduate students as a kind of reflective, we spoke with one another, talked about each other's work, and then we produced a text and work for this book. There are two copies in the back, and obviously, if you would like a copy, if you let me know, I'm sure Nikki will send it to you. So, I think the important thing is that I've been outside the academy for some time now and haven't talked, so it's very interesting being back in what I kind of think of as an academic space. So being outside is something that I'm really interested in, working in the margins, liminal spaces, interstitial spaces, and that idea of how one functions in the margins. I also live on a boat, which Foucault talks about as a heterotopic space, as the kind of liminal space par excellence, because it's not attached to anything, it's both outside and inside. And I tend to work in the hold of my vessel, which is a really important emotional space for me, the idea of being held in this space. So the work that I started to do was actually happened after I left teaching. And for 2 years I didn't make any work at all. That sense of complete dislocation that one experiences, I could really identify with our graduates that must be feeling this very similarly at the moment. You're kind of in this space of academia, and then suddenly you're outside that space. Nobody cares whether you make work, it's what I describe as the sound of one hand clapping. And so for 2 years I didn't make any work. And then I started to work with a blind woman who I asked if she would print me some braille cards with messages on that I intended to send through the post. And they said, out of touch, keep in touch. touch, so she typed these, and I spent quite a lot of time with her. And I asked her if she was completely blind and had been blind since she was totally blind and blind since she was three. And I asked her if she would do some drawings for me. And she said, no, but I'd sing you a song. And we talked a lot about drawing, and she said that the fear that she had about drawing was that she couldn't see it and therefore had no control over it. But obviously with her song that she had some control. One of my visits, she asked me if I, on subsequent visits, she asked me if I would have a look at her camera for her. And I was a little nonplussed. I'm glad she couldn't see my expression. And I said, yeah, sure. So she explained what was wrong with it, and I kind of had a look, and the shutter was a bit sticky. I sorted it out. And I went, why? How? Why are you using a camera? And she said that she takes it when she goes on a trip. She'd just been to Chatsworth House in Derbyshire with some friends, and she'd taken some photographs of Chatsworth House, which she was really happy to show me. And she explained that it situated her in a sighted world, that the camera became a possibility of a discourse that was denied her otherwise. And this really made me think, why do I take photographs? I began to question the need to take photographs. Who were they for? What would it mean not to take a photograph? Would I lose myself and the moment forever? Why was the lone experience of the moment not enough? What would be lost? And thinking about that, I started to think about how I could, if I didn't have this eye, this camera, in order to situate myself, how could I record or trace a kind of passing moment of time? And I started to make drawings. And the drawings I call blind drawings, in as much as I don't look at the drawings while I'm doing them. And they are created by, I usually have them in my bag as I'm walking, or have them on my lap if I'm on a train or in a car. And I started to create a whole series of drawings. So these blind drawings were created as I, what I call, performed the city, as I moved around. The book's called Pilgrimage. The most recent set of drawings define a pilgrimage of a different kind and record the traces of my journeys. And a particular set I did were journeys to visit my mother, who is terminally ill. They do not start from the premise of blankness or blindness, in fact, the opposite. As they are an overlay, because what I started to do was to use Derrida's book called Writing Performance, and there's a chapter in there called Cora. They do not start from premise of blanks or blindness, in fact the opposite, as they are an overlay, a palimpsest on pages of text. The texts are appropriated from a translation of Derrida's writings in the book, The Derrida Reader, Writing Performances, where I've drawn on some of the pages from the chapter titled Cora. Another set of works in the chapter called Writing and Scribble, because I'm really interested in the kind of link or relationship between handwriting and drawing. Record recent train journeys to Sheffield to the conference entitled Tourism and Performance, where I exhibited some of the drawings. Finn, a four-year-old son of a friend of mine, saw these drawings and exclaimed, "Who has scribbled in that book? You are not supposed to do scribble." I was mindful of my own childhood, where obviously the ultimate sin was to actually draw in a book. And then another set of drawings, which I did some yesterday. There's a few of my drawings that I just bought that of various journeys and things in here too. I mean, I have hundreds and hundreds of them now. But a set of drawings that I'm also quite interested in is, as part of the conference, was, and Claire's my particular favourite, is that I use two pencils, and while someone's speaking, I actually have the book on my lap and draw their hand gestures. So there's a series of drawings that I did yesterday at the conference. Those are Claire's, so she's my favourite because she does so much. And there was one of Jan Babette. Some people don't move their hands at all, which is very interesting. As I say, Claire's a particularly good example. And so this idea of writing notes and making the drawings, where the relationship between drawing and writing becomes completely And I did do some work with a conductor to the Philharmonic, and actually drew and made a series of drawings of the conductor at the concert. So I think that's
beautiful. And there's so many questions about the way that art thinks in order to open up practice. It's lovely.
Should we just happy you offer this
I mean, it's interesting because actually some of the things that I want to talk about sort of are also kind of acts of translation of the sort that you were talking about, really. And I just wanted to kind of just very briefly kind of scope out how some of the practice-based activities that people at GRISAP are engaged in sort of relate or intersect with, really, with sort of art, writing, and performance. And I've got sort of four main areas, really. To start with, we've been curating what we hope will be a series of books. One is on the table, Autumn Leaves, and one is sort of in press at the moment, which is called Play with Words. And in those books, we've kind of curated, edited, whatever you want to call it, artists, and invited them to translate their practices with sound for the printed page. And some of them, and some people have taken a range of approaches. You know, some of them have taken a sort of academic essay, some of them have taken more of an experiential essay, some of them have engaged in writing as practice, some of them have tried to use a sort of graphic way, but most of them are people who, well, we set them a sort of challenge, and a large percentage of them have kind of taken it up in some way. So, playing with words, actually, also deals with practices, artist practices with the spoken word, specifically. So, that is another area of practice-based research at GRISAP, which is a number of members are using spoken word extensively as material in their sort of compositional and sound works. And it varies how that's gathered. Sometimes, for example, in my case, I use a lot of archive or oral history material. Other people use sort of captured conversation. A lot of people use interviews in some way. But obviously, that's then kind of composed with rather than used purely as sort of documentary material. We're also developing, and this extends over to teaching quite a lot, the use of text-based scores for spoken, live spoken word performance work. We've recently done a project with the London Sinfonietta based around their Luigi Nono season, where we worked with students and with players from the London Sinfonietta, developing responses to Nono's work, but a lot of that related resulted in students producing new scores of work, which sort of relates to some of the card use stuff, which tangentially we were talking about yesterday. Another area of research is using pieces of text as a starting point for cross-arts collaboration. So at the moment I'm collaborating with long-term collaboration with choreographer Rosemary Butcher, and we are using text in different ways as a potential structuring device, sometimes as material, but often the text won't appear in any way in the sort of performative work. And finally, on that, on the compositional side of things, at GRISAP we've been developing software tools to help composition with both the spoken word and to data mine printed material for recomposing with letters, prints, that's sort of drawn from something else. And sort of finally, I suppose the other practice that we are developing is, and this might sound sort of slightly crazy, but listening as a creative practice. And there's levels of translation with that, really. On the one hand, there's the listening, and then there's the potential for trying to record what you hear. And what is happening a lot in people's recordings is that you might be somewhere and you can see something really fantastic, but all you can hear is actually howling gale and the sea or whatever it is. So there's a lot of practices where people find that they're actually performing to the microphone a lot, sort of describing or just interjecting or whatever. And in some cases, that's having a further translation into writing. And I just wanted to sort of hand over to Angus for a moment, because that is the core of his creative practice. And he just wanted to say a few things.
I'll be very brief, but I've been writing in public since the mid-1980s, and that writing has taken a number of forms, it's taken place in a number of locations, engaged with a number of subjects. The kinds of forms it's taken include things like journalism, criticism, commentary, a brief period of academic writing, a conventional form, which took place in the field of political theory. And then in the locations, I've looked for fanzines, for magazines, books, for journals, websites, exhibition catalogues, and on gallery walls. And in terms of the subject, I've written extensively about music and photography, a little bit about architecture, and then quite a bit that could probably be called cultural criticism. And then in recent years, and this is what Kathy was talking about, I've begun to be able to develop a kind of poetic writing, the very writing that my editors would always excise from my original contribution. And so it's the kind of detritus of the remainder of this previous history of professional or commercial aspect writing. And this poetic writing is intended to kind of evoke people and places and the sensory world that they inhabit. And it's very closely associated with listening. So it's a kind of travel writing about travelling, or travel writing, And I'm aware of the genealogy of writing as artistic practice. The genealogy is associated with the university and the London Institute of Recording. And I'm inspired by a number of different challenges that relate to the practice of writing as art. And if it's okay, I'd just like to kind of isolate seven of these challenges that I'm interested in, and I think a lot of us are certainly interested in our work. And one of the challenges is, what can writing as art do that other modes of expression can't? And conversely, what can writing as art not do that other modes of expression can? How can these different modes, including writing as art, collaborate with each other? Is it the same individual who participates in the way you were talking? Earlier on, or what happens when other different individuals, and this is something I've done before, when you work as a photographer or a filmmaker, and you write it as your part of the contribution, however. Well, I think there's an interesting relationship between writing and other literary registers, poetry, travel writing, experimental writing, criticism, and philosophy itself. What are the potential opportunities to cross the streams, to mix these things up, to put back in what the editors took out in other forms of writing? Just got a couple more. One of the things I'm interested in is, what's the relationship between writing as art and documentation? This kind of goes back to, why would you take a photograph? Why not just be there? Why don't you just use the sound on its own and neglect the imperative to frame that sound and to explain it? And then there's questions about, is writing as art only writing as art because of the context it appears in? Or does it possess certain formal properties, or, going back to what Chris Wainwright was saying yesterday, a certain agenda, thematic concern? And then, what are the relationships between this writing as art and its being spoken and read? And for me, I'm very interested in some of Wittgenstein's ideas about the inner voice, and the fact that we're spoken to before we speak, or spoken to in some sense before we write. But I'm also interested in what happens when we speak, however we write. That's something that I do. And what happens when people read those words, or listen to them. And what happens when I'm restricted to only speaking in English, and how that works as a form of creative practice. And then finally, how can writing become performing? And is there some kind of parallel between writing as composition and writing as improvisation? That's something I don't want to search.
That's fascinating. In some ways, I sort of feel this immediately, those prompts, and I like to think of as kind of prompts for discussion, almost open up the idea that we were having, struggling with yesterday, about art school model. Because, in fact, the notion of writing, which is sometimes in the curriculum sense an art school seems so thoroughly problematic, and I've thought about this a lot, is addressed through the way art thinks in such constructive and productive social ways. And in a way the discussion is both to respond even more with other exemplars of practice and also to say, and so, and where, you know, what do we offer and what do we then do, because it's these are ideas that we're working on very kind of clear and obvious in a way to us, and yet they're ones which are very particular to the kinds of sites and practices that we're involved in. It does take us right back to yesterday's talk, to talking about the Cornelius Cardew project. And one of the questions I wanted to ask is this a particularly interesting cultural moment for this? A friend of mine, Steve Clay, who's a publisher of Granary Books in New York, a very, very interesting experimental publishing house, has said that, for instance, there's been a huge reuse of the typewriter in the past few years, because what happens when the technology is superseded is that it becomes available for art. And so in a sense, I think something that's been happening to handwriting and the book itself is it's become reavailable for art. And that gives us the most amazing kind of liberating opportunity to look now at what the history of artists' engagement with writing, sonic, inscriptive practices are. Yeah, okay, well I'm just
going to
open that up.
I think one thing that's quite interesting this morning is, you know, with the practice space at PhD, and in a way, you know, that represents sort of, you know, one of the big chunks of writing that our students in school engage in. And I think in some ways there's a danger that a lot of the individual voices that the usual languages get edited out. And what happens is you get a kind of writing which apes academic discourse.
Yeah.
And actually doesn't really serve, you know, so you have, you know, we fought the battle of that art works can contain research and they can be part of the thesis. But in a way the way we regard the writing is actually very conservative.
Yeah.
And it's a model that isn't very good. And just as a further point, I mean, I think one of the things is that people are very unconfident about looking outside of a certain canon at models of writing about practice. But I mean, I would say Bob Dylan's Chronicles as one of the most perfect pieces of writing about practice-based research. And it's written in a voice which is incredibly distinctive. That you hear the you know, there's a wonderful narrative. It's structured in an incredibly intelligent way. But the evidence that it draws on, actually saying about how he went about understanding the territory, is absolutely wonderful. It's in a way what we expect from a PhD. But students aren't looking you know, they really can't, or things like that. So I suppose I would sort of appeal to a kind of a widening of possibilities of writing.
As a supervisor, I feel that I'm very much engaged in the disciplinary process to stop students doing that. You know, I'm very conscious of the fragility of people who practice.
Well, I think the investment that the student is putting in invariably leads the supervisor to be more conservative.
Yeah.
Because if you come to the final thesis and it fails, then in a way the supervisor has a kind of moral responsibility as well as the students. But
I think it's really interesting, because I mean, I've examined thesis where this has been an issue.
So you don't have visual art students working with text and
no, that's not really the.
No.
It's more about the thesis component that attaches to the creative practice in some strange form.
But that means that as a sector, you become much more vociferous in articulating actually the requirements for different ways of writing within the PhD regulations. Because in the end, I fully agree with you, but as a supervisor, one carries also a degree of responsibility for the PhD. PhD student, I have been in a situation where I've encouraged my PhD students to push the envelope. And that wasn't really welcomed by the external examiners who came from a practice-based PhD background and insisted on the very rigorous format of the thesis.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, one has a moral obligation, and therefore the regulations need to be broadened and made more flexible to accommodate our disciplinary needs.
Mm. Do they need to have, for instance, there's a really interesting, we've done it kind of, it hits the nub of some of the questions that we now hit in the art school. And what Anne Angus Akapi have also done is to suggest that there is a huge amount of historical and contemporary evidence for approaches that are very different. They come from within art.
Yeah.
They don't come from outside it. Art has been thinking about these things for a very long time. But we have this problem of recognition, apart from anything else. And what do we then do? Because we seem to also have a problem of recognising ourselves in terms of who we want to be when we, for instance, do examine or we create new kinds of curricula. We're still keeping certain things within
mm-hmm.
a particular art school practice model, and then we're saying, yes, but you know, you're going to have to do this. And this is actually what's proper. And what we do may be improper,
mm-hmm.
and that's what we all like doing.
Mm-hmm.
But the proper bit, everybody in this room has had issues with those things.
To do with, I think, lack of confidence within the sector, because I mean, not only within the PhD environment, it's also within the recent research assessment exercise, but we've been dealing with exactly the same sorts of problems with how we actually describe our practice without actually subscribing to the more academic research language.
Hello, were you going to?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think being outside and looking back in again, I mean, it is something, I mean, I'm very aware that particularly with the drawings that I do directly onto Derridian text, is a very deliberate comment on Derridian text. And I realised that it is a kind of reactive process, because when I was in the academy, in the art school, I was really concerned about the limitations of writing. And I don't know whether any of you were ever involved in Writing Pad.
Yeah.
But they did do some very innovative things, and they certainly allowed me and gave me permission as I was in charge of the thesis, that 30-year thesis. And they gave me a lot of permission and freedom that was supported by the external examiners to allow students to articulate through their own voice. And that was just so fantastic. And the kinds of texts and the fact that someone could have a dissertation that was writing as practice, not this kind of theoretical kind of incantation, literally, of someone reading a text and then kind of repeating it. So it was very, but I felt, somebody made a comment that what we were doing was actually maybe precluding these students from being able to go on to PhD because we weren't encouraging them to write in a way that would be acceptable. So there was a real tension there, and I sensed a kind of nervousness about, yes, it's all very well, but perhaps they're not very good academics anyway, and so therefore that, but I also think from a language point of view, we had a lot of students from overseas, and it was amazing for them. Some of the works, because they were allowed to use the word Ireland to talk about the notion of experience in a way, it was just incredibly liberating, and I think these things are exposed and discussed enough, this whole thing of the idea of a PhD by practice, but there's still this weight of a body of text that has to be produced in a very, very particular and very traditional way.
There's an odd binary, isn't there?
Yes.
But in the sense that there's a tremendously prescriptive and obviously very important set of preconditions and that you have to meet in order to write properly.
Mm-hmm.
But the other side of that is always the personal, from the heart, and there is another way as well, and that's what we're kind of looking at here.
I think there's a fundamental problem within formal education in that you're asking a student to be able to write about themselves, get to a point of doing a PhD by practice, when throughout their whole school life, as speaking an individual has been suppressed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my challenge as a writer are working in creative writing, and even the notion of creative writing is an oxymoron, because you think, well, what is the rest of our writing? I thought it was all creative. Culturally, is the notion in society of what is a writer and what is writing? And the challenge always in workshops is you spend half the time trying to demystify what writing and writers do. And that is the challenge. And so inbuilt, you know, from a very early age, there's this sense of what writing and what writers do, but fundamentally, what is language? Mm. And language seen as something that is a vacuum, and it's not. It's bounded, it's about power. My kind of take and interest in language and writing came from the fact that I felt that I spoke three languages at home. A kind of Creole in what was my family, a kind of Jamaicanized English on the street, and then an English in school. And where did these kind of languages intersect? How are they negotiated? How are they contextualized? Where do you use them? And in what kind of specific purpose, for what ends and for what strategies? And I think working with students, for instance, at London College of Communication, visual arts students, who the emphasis, produce the work. And then it's now, well, let's talk about yourself. Well, we've never been asked to talk about ourselves before. We've never looked at kind of identity in terms of our practice. And so it's a real challenge, and it's more than unconfidence, it's fear of even putting pen to paper. And what's the significance and what might that mean? And then to also be able, in terms of writing, to let that go, to just let it go as an exercise. It's probably nothing to do with you. It's there on the page, and allow it to just happen. So these are the kind of challenges, I think, that go much beyond kind of the academy, really, and go fundamentally to kind of like how language and writing is seen within formal education. So.
But just look at blogging, though, how that has completely liberated a whole, not just a generation, but people who felt they couldn't write. And I mean, really, there is a lot of mundane writing on blogs and things, but fantastic stuff, but people will never, ever, ever have the confidence
to type it on a piece of paper and say, here, this is what I have to say. And I find that really interesting, what's happening on the internet is really a revolution in terms of self and being able to kind of speak to people and to be heard. Oh, just one point. Do people then see it blogging, and I agree with you in terms of the way language is being affected by text culture, do people then see that as validate that as writing?
Mm. Exactly. Well, that's probably not.
Yeah, it sort of relates to the stuff you were talking about, having like three languages. My main language is Greek, my second language is English. When I published the book, which you can all see it here, where I actually describe all my performance, so I've done a very careful description, because no one else can have this understand my performance from my point of view, because the person who works at the other point of view. I decided to write it in English and then have it translated into Greek, because the book is bilingual. The reason I did that is because I thought that as an artist, I'm using art as a language anyway, so now I'm also going to use language as part of my creative task, so to speak. And part of it is also, it has a kind of political attitude, which is if we are all equals in a way, then my use of language, for as long as it is not totally incoherent, it is just as good, and it's possibly more accurate to the way I understand it, I want the things I want to express, than a translator's understanding of my possibly pigeon English. Okay? That's one thing I want to contribute. The other is that, again, it has to do with the same book. When the book was presented, a woman was involved in the presentation of the book, which was done in the Museum of Athens, and she's a theatrologist. And she teaches theatre in Berlin, the drama school there. she proposed afterwards that my scripts, this is what she called the descriptions of the performances, were then given away as scripts actually for other students to make a performance. I'm just sort of contributing this because I have not made up my mind as what to do. I'll tell you quite honestly, my first reaction was horror. It's like, this is my performance. How can someone possibly, you know, take it and translate it? But it's an open question, and it's a very interesting question. And in a way, if I really do not want this to happen, it raises the question of me having to state it before I die. So I have to make a point. Really tell people, you know, like, keep away, you're not allowed to touch this writing. Like, that's how I have not decided as yet, but it was a very interesting occurrence. It's only 2 years ago, so I really have not made that in mind because it's an important issue.
What was the name of the book for that?
It's called Films, Video, Performances, Film and Video, and has been my work from 1969 to 2004, I think, that the book was published.
Could you not consider, because of that situation, where you would actually make something that would specifically be like a script or set?
Yes, I have.
Right.
Yes, I have. Mm-hmm. I have not done anything about it because
right.
It is all very connected with a sort of, say, a way of, a kind of preoccupation that I've been in for the last few years.
Mm.
It has to do with all of my work and archiving, so maybe I it will carry us to the second, you know, the second part of today's. But yes, definitely I am thinking about it.
Because I was thinking of something like Yoko Ono's Grapefruit, which I haven't got yet.
Well,
and the instructions in there, I mean, are just for anyone. I mean, they are her performances, but there is this sense of one being able to take those actions.
Yes, I think Beckett has done some better than me. One has to be aware of the actual, the height of the limits within which
yes.
one is working.
Mm-hmm.
Because the best, it is there.
Yes.
Of course, one can. Can one use it within that interest?
Mm-hmm.
It's a very complicated issue.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
For the time being, Beckett.
There are a number of people who want to enter into the conversation there. Amalia, do you, and then Catherine and Michael.
I was interested in the conversation dealing with the waiving the language for the academia in order to be allowed to exit the academia. And I was thinking in connection to what you said that writing, even speaking, is forming some form of linearity, and either your point of view is a linearity, meaning that you translate something into scribble, but it's not scribble, it's writing. More or less what I'm thinking in connection to yesterday's table is about translating the language of art, as we have said, to writing, therefore to a language that can be communicable to another, to a more wide, let's say, audience. And this is a problem of why art is research and how, or is it possible to translate this kind of research into a body of knowledge that can be shared to another language. So we are talking about linearities and structure in terms of linearities. And yet again, as artists, we know that we kind of work chaotically and even backwardly, meaning that time kind of works like positively and negatively at the same time. So writing kind of denies you this freedom. And yet again, you need to use it in order to translate what you do and create a text. So I think more or less what we are talking about in terms of performance and writing is about whether we can translate art into another language.
Can I say a couple of minutes?
The notion of translation.
question might be there, and it's a really interesting one, if I sort of help to move on in a sense, is that that intersection is one of the ones that perhaps art is also thinking about opening up. So in the question that we might move on to think about, it's really interesting that we've focused on curriculum, if you like, immediately, because we kind of know that writing is perceived as highly problematic in our curriculum, but that, as we've all said, art has methods to address it. And I think within the concept of literary translation, there are quite a few artists and poets now working on that idea of what that notion is. Do you translate back or forward? Do you translate into Shakespearean English? Do you work with Chaucerian English and translate it forward into digital text? But what, and where we might kind of think then is, how do we create this a body of knowledge or evidence, and how might we intervene in creating those things which support, not just in a functional sense, but which kind of really provide models and exemplars and the kind of expanded field of writing that really may help to and exchange, share all of this approach. And why can't art also address literary translation, for instance? Mm. Art can do that.
So let's take Sarah.
So just, well, I mean, it's a few responses to things people have said that I've been thinking while you've been saying them. And the first is that I think I agree with most of what people have been saying, but I also think there's a danger always of reinforcing the split between the creative and the critical, which I don't uphold, because I'm both a practitioner and a writer, but a theoretical writer, and I do not feel that I'm any less creative in my critical writing, and nor do I feel when I'm a practitioner that I'm somehow more intuitive, more chaotic, you know, and so I think there is a way, and I also don't think it's exclusive to art practice, that it's that artists are special and different in some way, and I also think it's dangerous to kind of keep reinforcing that idea as well. And then I think there's different kinds of writing, and that writing functions in very different ways. There's writing as art, as you said, but then there's writing that runs alongside of art practice, or wishes to follow it, or wishes to create a response to it that is an artistic response, if you like, but through writing. And then I also think that in terms of the PhD, I do think it's really important to uphold certain standards within a PhD, because it's about certain kinds of skill and certain kinds of technique that can facilitate, that can enable you to write about practice really, really well. And I trained in a performance studies department where that kind of work is really, really being done now, to kind of really investigate the way that you can respond poetically but critically to performance. So I do think it's possible, and I do think there are skills to be learned, to not throw the baby out with the bathwater. I know the whole kind of the sort of deathliness of academic prose is awful, but I also think it can be very creative, that we shouldn't always have to leave out that voice, and that the critical voice is a deeply poetic one. And finally, and then I'll stop going on, I guess the thing is to say that, you know, you talk about intuition and chaos, and that in a way writing denies you that, and I'm not sure that it does. I think it asks you to be to bring that chaos and intuition to the table, and then it asks you to patiently order it. Mm. And the best critical writing, as we all probably know, is that which has that voice, like someone like Benjamin, who is the most beautiful poetic writer, but you know, you read the thesis on the philosophy of history, unbelievably dense and difficult, but you have to have incredible patience with theory, because theory is another language, it's another language, and it's one you have to learn and take time with, and I guess that's
unfold
and be with it for a long time, not just stick it on as I read this stereo and I'm going to stick it on, which is what we see a lot of it takes, you know, it takes time, I think, to learn that way of thinking.
And I think, yeah, that brings a lot more to the table as well, I think, we then want to pick up, and I ask Anne, and then...
Yeah, well, that was quite a lot of things. Lots of them. It's not that I don't agree with them. I think it's their contentious issues. I think there should be different models of writing.
Yeah.
would be very fearful that one style of writing can get out and do all quite well. I think the other thing that I would say is also, I think art is a difficult language too, and
yeah.
needs time, and that's the trouble.
Yes.
People don't give it that.
Yeah.
And in that way that, say, what is it that they reckon that people spend on average 3 seconds in front of a painting, and how can you begin to evolve the language of understanding or critique if that's the kind of time. But just to go quickly back to the other comment about language and translation, I think it is a really interesting problematic in the sense that art always is returned back to language, what I call the space of translation, whether we're watching a performance, reading a text, looking at a painting, where, rightly or wrongly, predominantly beginning to form a set of words or feelings that are articulated through a language. So as I say, whatever form we work on, it always does return back to the spoken or written one.
I think it's wrong if I sort of gave the impression that sort of poetic writing isn't critical writing. Because, you know, I think, you know, one can easily sort of slip into that. I mean, I was recently looking at a page from Finnegan's Wake.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for an example of self-criticism, you know, there's about 3 words that survived, you know. And you really get the sense of, you know, that, you know, every word being necessary. And I think that, you know, in poetry, you know, the meaning of the word, the weight of the word, the placement of the word, these are all intensely critical issues. I think just sort of following up on the point that Anne said about this relationship between art and the text, I think that there is beginning to be a sort of quite a worrying nailing down of art by text.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for example, in the Louise Bourgeois show at the Tate, some of the text was mind-bogglingly dark, to the extent that it actually denied the experience of actually looking at it.
Absolutely.
I mean, there was one piece which was very clearly either a vagina or an arm, and oscillated between the two, but was neither one or the other. And the text explained this. So instead of, you know, that wonderful moment when you're looking at this and you see the eye, and then you see something which you don't actually want to put a word to, and those two thoughts hover in your head, and that's where the poetry exists.
Exactly.
There you're told,
yeah.
Blah blah, on to the next one.
Yeah.
And I do find that so depressing. The fact that a lot of the text isn't actually encouraging looking. I mean,
or thinking or
experience.
You know, that visual engagement and what goes on in the head.
Exactly.
It's trying to nail it down with words, and I think that's not doing it.
Can I ask, at this stage just ask Michael Hilbert, because I think that, do you want to make a
just
a
point?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the artistic practice, I think it's a very important thing to write down. And as you say, it can be very wrongly done. So it's a kind of testimony, in fact, what you said. You want to write it down before you're there, and to reserve it. And others can use it as a script and to go on with it. Or you have, it's kind of writing the truth. So I was asking myself, how much poetics can you use in writing the truth? And how important are religious, is a religious vocabulary here? Because you said it's a pilgrimage, the book is called Pilgrimage, and you use the word death and testimony and writing down things. And so I was wondering, like, how important are there, what kind of writing are we using when we are writing about artistic works?
Personally, I'm using a very dry, descriptive language.
Like
cookery. It's like it's like a recipe. But I say, you know, you're very welcome, and I do it very consciously. About it. using a very dry, down-to-earth description. I walked for 3 hours from there to there. It was very hot. The graves were untended. You know, it was like the driest possible, with very short sentences. And I edit and re-edit and re-edit the writing until I make it as dry as possible.
Can I just say, can I turn it, to move us on slightly from that? Because in a sense, there's a whole discussion there. I was going to quote Helen C. Sue's great phrase about, you know, to begin writing, you have to have death.
Yes.
The grave and engraving, you know, of course, the grave and images, you know, they're entirely connected. Writing begins, in a sense, with the monument and so on. And then the script. But also, can we slightly move it on to, because I think we're in danger of getting into that discussion where text is seen to close down. And that's one of the problems we have in art schools as well. And it seems to be functional, and which is what kind of Paul's comment about, you know, that it becomes exceptionally functional as soon as it sees art, it kind of becomes functional. But what Angus and Kathy and Anne were also referring to earlier on was, look, these are exemplars about the way in which art's methods open up the expanded field of writing, and this is where there are things happening. Art has a material, I mean, writing has a material, sonic, graphic presence. It might all be seen as graphing, in a sense, you know, that it's making a process of mark making. Because I'm wondering if there are ways in which thinking about writing in that opened way that we do in art schools connects all kinds of things, from typography to design to sound to the graphing of photography. And how might we begin to do research in that body of knowledge and to put that out there that helps once again to develop that? Because I'm not sure we always do know or recognise what we're already doing. You see what I mean? Somebody else says that. Susan, can you speak up? You're on a desk space. Yeah.
And the terms of the conversation, the context of the conversation.
About writing specifically.
Because you said, just now,
Sarah, yes.
You performed the conversation that you were talking about. You said that the writing. And I think it's a question of that the writing, it's always a conversation in the other. And this question of the other will change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's understanding the conversation act, so it goes back to something you were saying about giving away. What happens as soon as there is a text or whatever, it's given away to interpretation, and then maybe it comes back. I think that the word conversation for me is a really resonant one of thinking through this. If you can't be asked, what are the terms of the conversation?
Well, what are they actually? I mean, in a sense, can we even move back on to what are the terms of the conversation that we're having in art school about that relationship between art and writing? And by performance, I'm sort of including the notion of the event, the event of writing, the eventness that Anne refers to. Can we change those terms? And because we are incredibly good at lots of things, like printing and creating work with the materialities of writing as well, as artists and in art practice, how are the terms of that conversation being constituted?
I think I would be reluctant to insist on to prescriptive set of boundaries around that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I think the community strategy comes a lot about, and I wonder how much that conversation is one that we want to define, you know, in terms of vocabulary, some kind of grammar or some kind of turn taking. You know, I think that I would like to see a different kind of conversation. Being one that could take place, and I wonder whether there is also some strategic role for the monologue as well, which is kind of has the post-structure rejoined that there is no such thing as a monologue, there's been a conversation before we've reached that point, but there are different modes of expression and modes of engagement, and sometimes, as in other artistic practices, the conversation isn't what either intended or possible within the framework of a particular form of artistic practice, and I think that's fine. Mm. But I think if your question is about how within kind of disciplinary framework, pedagogy framework, that conversation can continue. I'd still want to see some openness. Yesterday we heard from some of the students that they felt that that conversation wasn't a possible one at certain times in certain locations. And I think that that's the roles of contestation at that point are ones which need to have reservations attached to
them. Can I take Kirsten, because there's so many people to be
with other disciplines, because I mean, I think we are in agreement that certain standards of rigor need to be negotiated, and in relation to that, we have to think about content, style, register, the pragmatic settings, and so on. And the contestations do not just apply to the art school, they apply to literary criticism as much as they apply to history writing, etc. So I'm, maybe because we are embedded with an university set up, I'm very much for opening up our doors to other players and have some debate, and including the natural science, to communicate knowledge produced there, or in engineering, which is practice-based, but has a certain kind of standardized format of writing up.
Well, thinking about Princess Hannah's writing as event or performance take place in engineering would be to turn the poetics of the art approach into engineering, and that would be a fantastic discussion, for instance. That's the kind of thing that, as an mode of operation, would be the kind of thing we could do. I think Amalia and then Marsha.
Yeah, I was thinking at the moment translation and conversation before. Talking about leaping from one to the other, we ended up dealing with the old conflict between theory and practice, critical writing versus the practice of art, which I don't think that we should keep thinking in this line of duality, because actually structuring the linearity is creativity. Either you do it with the camera and editing, or you do it with the or with a piece of paper drawing on it. So more or less what we are talking about is our sense of identity while we are doing this linear, let's say, thing, which may be whatever. And that sense of identity may need a collaborative aspect in order to translate, and I'm not talking translation in terms of two languages, because I'm also a person who uses two languages, but more or less about osmosis between a practice and another practice, because definitely art is a cognitive practice, and if I collaborate, which I have with another tradition, through the act of drawing, very peculiarly we kind of learn to, and teach to each other different modes of thinking processes. So I think what we're talking about is a sense of self and how it is structured through creativity, and whether this sense of self can be enlarged to incorporate and other people within it. Therefore, you have a collective practice rather than private practice.
Can I take Marsha?
I just would like to go back to Angus's comment.
Can you speak up a little bit?
Sure. Certainly, in my experience, that it's limited in quite a curious way that I think relates to performativity, insofar as, although I am encouraged in some respects to sort of experiment with my writing, ultimately, I'm told, you know, you have to be clear because your readers have got a certain, they've got a limited amount of time. They need to be able to access the text, like they need to be able to access the meaning. So that kind of gets confounded in a way, because ultimately I have to kind of deliver up something that I think is supposed to be easily digestible, and I find that problematic when you're really supposed to be encouraging creativity.
It goes back to the problem, doesn't it, whether you are writing as a research student or as a research project, as Sarah was saying, that when you're outside the system, you're writing for your own creative practice, your own practice, your own work, where the rules are not there. But when you're inside the system, inside the institution, and as a research student or anyone who's doing their research, you do have rules and regulations that are different. No matter how we might try and kind of work alternatives to the framework, I'm trying to have alternatives take place within me, between my writing and my practice. And I know it's almost easier to do it with someone else. It's almost easier to have another practitioner or another artist or working together as a collaboration. It seems to quite better. But within myself, I have this real struggle. And I do go on. Separation comes externally. I've been told so many times on my writing, my email, it's not exegetical enough, it's too poetic.
Yeah.
So, like you, the poetry goes out.
Yeah.
And it's looking at the remains of that. But I want to, I spin another way, I want it to work in both as thoughts, and I want the practice base to be something that can be both.
It's although it could be argued that everything you put out into the public domain is examined, but you know, your thesis is being examined against a set of criteria.
I just wanted to be sort of pragmatic about it in some ways, because I mean, writing, you know that you're writing, it's a skill.
Mm.
When you're doing a PhD, if it's not in writing, you're usually developing another body of work. And actually, for most PhD students, in my limited experience, they do a big bit of writing for their BA. Goodness said, how long it's between all these things. They do another big bit of writing for their BA. And then they might not do anything else until they have to do a PhD thesis. I mean, how can you possibly have developed that skill, that dramatic thing, really? I mean, surely that's something you develop post-PhD. And in a way, your thesis for the PhD is more to do with the kind of amalgamation of a huge amount of information and thought and content, and you try and get it together in the best way you possibly can. I mean, if we were, sorry, just one last thing, I mean, if we were really, as a university, you know, writing should be taught alongside PhD, if that's what we really want to see us as it. Yeah.
But I don't think it is. Would you use that same criteria about the visual aspect of it? That's what I find like interesting. It's now almost like the writing is, I think maybe it's the background of the visual. I mean, the presentation of the writing is another aspect, which is how the writing is presented. You get the consciousness of the writing to the audience. And that has an implication. So I have a very, very crucial PhD writing, and I'm writing words.
I come from another point of view. We as an institute, we publish books. And we also published a brochure or we helped to publish a brochure about research at our university. So we are setting standards, we are defining rules, we are defining language, we are doing testimony. This is us, right? And this kind of writing is very much oriented on academic standards, of course. We are using the standards, we are redefining language to apply for our work. And we published books about artistic research, so we wrote truth about artistic research. We used the true words, not poetic words, to say what the artists did. Of course, we did poetics in a way, academic poetics. And then the problem is, I think, that if we would do an artist's book, like a book as an artistic work, how would people see it if they see our name as an institute on the back of the book, or the name of a publishing house, which is normally publishing these things, you know? So
you say the truth isn't in the artist?
We've got a linguistic issue, isn't it? The notion of truth.
Yes, I mean, we helped now publish a journal which is exactly in between the two. It was started by two young artists, and they published a journal on art philosophy. So they, as like 22-year young men, invited Badiou, etc., and asked him their questions or asked him for the text, etc. So this is completely contrary to any academic strategy, because in academia you first have to do this and that and that and that, and finally, if you're old and have your range of titles, you can do a journal. And you will have a board that is advising you, etc. And they just came up with the idea, oh, we would like to have, we have a friend, he had the text of Derrida unpublished, maybe we could. And they just started to do something. And I think now it's slightly changed, and one more, how to say, more advanced person started to jump in. But for us, this was the thing, that they do it as an artistic project. It's an artwork, it's an art, it's an artistic book, and not an academic book. And for us, this is really difficult. Can we do that?
So I think that's a fantastic example, because I think people should look at this book that Michael's talking about. And just see what they think about it.
It's this journey.
Michael also points to a very important point, and that is the circuits of dissemination that are actually playing a key role in validating practices. And with the new research excellence framework, if we don't get our act together and put the foot down against the nomination of the 200 journals in the arts and humanities that are the leading journals and in which we all have to publish in order to have our practices validated, we will be screwed as a sector. Sorry for my strong language on that, but that wasn't what I wanted to say early on. I think to think about writing at PhD level is far too late.
Yeah.
The model of practice-based research, which had a very important political function to play in order to establish art's role and function as higher order thinking, etc., etc., has also prevented or has also reinforced the split between practice and theory, so that theory and history within the art school setting are regarded as service deliveries rather than being integrated.
Yeah.
And I think we need to start integrating historical and theoretical concerns with the practical concerns right from the start at undergraduate level throughout the program in order to actually have the time and the capacities to think about writing and its different functions and guises, etc.
I really absolutely agree, I think, with everything that you just said, and in a sense it pushes it further on. And I mean, what we've been doing in this discussion for a bit is dealing with the problematics of the central problem that we have of writing. It then focuses on this strand that goes through, probably from the early writing to
PhD, but I'm really interested in whether, despite being screwed if we don't take part in the journals and having edited a peer-reviewed journal as well, that whether there are things in arts methods, because we talked about methodology yesterday, that can actually enter that field. For instance, the poet Charles Bernstein has been incredibly influential in the United States. He wrote a very brilliant academic essay called The Rhetoric of Artifice as a piece of poetry. And it's brilliant. And his other thing about what makes poetics poetic is he's got a little video on the web, actually, which you can download, where he simply starts, looks at his watch for a minute, and then stops it and says, it's all in the timing. It's about, if you like, just the intellectual intervention. How do we make intellectual interventions that make the expanded field of writing actually abrade?
Is that a word?
Have an abrasive relationship with this. I mean, in performance research, I'll just say very briefly, which I co-founded and I edited for 12 years, it is peer reviewed, and we found a way in which we said to the publisher from the beginning, we have to have 20 pages in every issue, which have to be for using the site of the page as a space of experiment, and it's still peer reviewed. And that we constantly try to kind of cross that boundary between the scholarly, whatever they come together, the melding point of the scholarly and the other kind of writing experiment practice. It's a very difficult thing to do, actually. Mm. Can I take
just
Maria?
Just briefly, just in relation to what you were saying, that it kind of just picks up on a few things that I've been thinking throughout, but I'm trying to remember them. I think that currently it is an interesting moment, what you were saying earlier, and I think in the sense that there are there are courses now springing up to do with art writing. I think there's, I want to say something about histories of writing in art institutions generally. And I think that certainly since the 1980s, there's already a very extensive body of different kinds of formative writing. There are lots of different models that are established, but I don't think we have recognised them yet as actually being histories that we can actually use as source histories. And I think the history that we seem to fall into without even thinking where did it come from and why are we doing it, and I think we should do it, but it shouldn't be the only thing that we do and just fall into without reflecting on it, comes out of this much earlier, goes back centuries to this kind of like idea of aesthetics and this, you know, idea of, which is maybe why people are reading Kant, that what you were saying earlier. And there is this almost duty that I think one can feel as a researcher that you need to somehow, that this is where you have to look to pursue questions at a deeper level because of this connection between the philosophy of art and the art institution. But I think it does go back, I mean, there are different histories of it in different countries, but it does go back quite a long way. And I think we just, and then that gets intersected with the different kinds of histories of art history that have had a very, since the 60s really, have again, so there's lots of things I think, there was kind of like theoretical imposition that became a kind of the new art history sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then performative writing, I think, really grows out of a reaction against that. And I think it would be interesting to really trace some kind of lineage and history of all of these different kinds of writing and offer different kinds of writing models. Mm-hmm. And certainly, the other thing, I think, certainly at Chelsea on the BA, we do attempt to, that is the ethos of the course, is to actually encourage this writing as a way of thinking, a different way of thinking, but a different way of thinking about yourself and how your practice might engage in a wider context in the world. And while on the one hand there is that ethos, I mean, I have to say that the people who do better, the students who do better, do end up often being the ones who do follow this aesthetics model. Mm-hmm. However, more and more, and I think this is going to be encouraged more and more because there now are the beginnings of more established models being taught at, there's a new art writing MFA at Goldsmiths starting up next year. So I think there's going to be a whole lot of other histories and bibliographies that can be sourced to actually build other histories, other research models. And then the final thing, when I did my PhD, I started it in the year 2000, and it was it's a theoretical PhD, but my goal was to actually do kind of poetic writing. There was some poetic writing at the end. However, it was interesting that was ignored, because that was ignored at the examination, as if you didn't, it wasn't actually in it. And even though it's a theoretical PhD, I have noticed that it is actually the external examiner, whose name will not be mentioned, has actually listed it as a fine art PhD, as if it didn't make that merit of being, you know, there was some notion that this. Even it wasn't discussed at the examination. I did pass and everything. I didn't have to make any corrections or anything like that. But I thought it was interesting. And the other thing, is that some poetic writing, I think there does need to be training, because the other thing about this performative writing, some of it is really interesting, really good. And I think what we need to do is have like standards of recognition, because a lot of it is very bad. One would not want the proliferation of very bad poetry writing.
Can
which
I
has
ask
happened.
Someone else? Because you've just come in, haven't you? Can you say who you are as well? Sorry?
I can wait my turn off.
No, you can speak, but I want to know who you are, because you just
Mary Ann Francis.
Oh, Mary Ann Francis, great.
Hi. I actually have a question for Maria about aesthetics, but I was going to talk about some come back to when I was asking to come on my PhD. I can name the examiners, so it was distorted. And because I was interested in the aesthetics of diversity, one of the things I wanted to do with the writing bit was to look at different modes of writing. Mm-hmm. So actually, although it was sort of slightly spooky, stories, anecdotes, historical quotations, other forms of spoof, 3D pictures. So I pushed the boundaries, and me going back to the bio was brilliant. There wasn't any question of it not being appropriate, and that was in 2000.
Aesthetics is much more complicated than what I was referring to. I'm just referring to a very shorthand history of philosophy,
mm-hmm.
Have it Plato, Kant, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Having to trace some kind of, you know, what is the meaning.
Yeah.
Kind of hermeneutics, I suppose.
Yeah.
Just be more precise.
Yeah.
Which I find can be a more obfuscating than illuminating in terms of, depending on the individual practice. I think it has to do with the individual practitioner, what their needs are. But often I think the sense of duty that this is a way you have to go can actually inhibit practitioners for whom it is not actually appropriate, but they feel constrained within the institutional framework to go there. And often we promote this model without even thinking that we're doing that. I think sometimes I'm guilty as well.
Can
you
I just
kind of orthodox?
Yeah, it just, and we don't think about why we're using it.
Can I just say that let's finish in about 10 minutes. But before we spent a huge amount of time, we keep focusing back on the PhD, this kind of real problematic area of writing, almost like we can't. It's magnetising us into, and it's in there in the middle somewhere. But can just before we stop, could we just have a real turn of that discussion to the idea of what we are making with writing as well around here? We've all got a huge number of books. We've talked about the fact that we need to enter into certain discursive environments, both Kirsten and Michael in our publishing. But are there ways, really, of working in that expanded field, graphing inscriptively, that can be really productive and immediately, you know, brought in Pilgrimage as an exemplar that uses
various notions of graphic writing and the performance writing event as well. Because I think that could be a very interesting collaborative project. And I also think there could be a really interesting international collaborative project around postgraduate art writing performance, you know, named international MA/MPhil MFA that we could kind of get involved in as well. And I think, you know, thinking about the things we could, can do, I'm just wondering if we can put a couple of those on the table as well.
It's not really my field, but I feel that some of the discussion that we've had in terms of collaboration, I mean, I think there's enormous potential within the theatre.
Yeah.
And I think that's when I sort of...
How do you mean within the theatre?
Well, I think there's just there are a lot of colleagues who work at Wimbledon within theatre design and theatre studies who would be very relevant to this sort of discussion.
Mm.
And I think we suffer a bit within the university for compartmentalising fine arts and other disciplines as well as
And I just want to add to that that what I was saying about my PhD wasn't to do with it actually, but in 2000 when I started, I went up to a conference in Manchester in the performance studies department, and they just didn't have these problems. They were doing fantastic things. They had already established models, and they were doing writing and act. And it was inspiring.
Yeah, you're completely right. Sarah and I spoke at Roehampton last week, actually, at a performance, because we both work on performance, and we spoke as a performance practice-based event, and I've got to say the standard was phenomenal. It's like performance studies, because theatre came partly, performance studies are much more theatre than fine art in a way, it came from such a dreadful place, and it had to kind of jump over the leotard moment, the mime, juggling, and it now is this a very different moment. And we could work with them.
Yeah.
I mean, there are people like Adrian Heathfield at Roehampton as well, we can kind of bring in. He's done a lot of work on performative writing. And I think we need to get over some of our disciplinary conflict and use those models.
They didn't have baggage, I think that's the problem.
Well, they had baggage,
but
it's
not the same in the context that we're talking.
No.
I think it's interesting that the word context hasn't come up in the entire conversation, and the whole thing about dialogue. So much dependent on context, like students speaking yesterday. In a way, they were sort of out of context. There was this lone voice, kind of positioned at the back, trying to be. But the context was not quite right. And as I say, so many things that we're talking about seem to be about the about context.
But there's some of those contexts to collaborate on and publishing and developing kind of curricula. That actually allow us to push this area forward. I mean, it's an area I'm really interested in.
And I think from the beginning, from the end.
Because
who are going to be the future PhD students?
Mary, I'm about to say, if I might
just to say that I've been charged with...
Can you speak a bit more? You're in a dead
just
zone.
To say,
before.
I've been charged with the task of looking into the possibility of setting up a writing research.
Oh, great. Can we be in it?
Sorry.
Can we all be in it?
Yes, well, this is an invitation. It's very great to be on it. So I've only spoken to a few people about it. But already, people like Tim O'Reilly, Kate McLeod from Kingston, and we've sort of talked about things like publishing, postgraduate seminars, really, anything.
And Cathy, and then Cathy.
I just want to briefly say that I feel that the different disciplines and their baggage is very interesting. And actually, in sound, arguably, we haven't really got much baggage.
No.
We're just sort of like wandering into its area, and it's like, oh, And I mean, obviously, music has got a language that it writes in that is completely incomprehensible to anybody that doesn't really do music. So yeah, I just wanted to sort of add that, that actually the disciplines aren't
They're not, yeah.
Even within here, I claim for the same events.
Yeah, we are in the process of setting up a research institute, a series of lectures and workshops in the area of, and don't quote me on the title, art writing, object capturing. The issue is that we didn't want to be exclusively art. We wanted to include our designers as in the first instance and see that as a way of rolling these activities out over a number of years with very focused events for undergraduates, postgraduates and PhD students as well as staff and public elements in order to precisely deal with aspects that have been brought up in the discussion, and we would be happy to collaborate and exchange in doing that.
Well, I think that, you know, it's what's sort of emerging for me in a way of my own research centre and embryonically thinking about how to identify itself should really be, if you like, a space of connection where those things can kind of come in, where we might further generate them. So collaboration, I think, is part of the kind of order of the day, really.
Can I just say one more thing? Quickly, that what my concern, you know, I think it's interesting that these spaces are being of writing are kind of being created, but my concern would be that, to some extent, is that the work that's going on in the at the moment is about working on the edges or challenging the kind of margins of things, and it's because there are these rules that therefore give you permission to actually contest the rules.
Yeah.
As soon as you give it permission, then obviously I think that may be problematic. Certainly from my point of view, it would problematise things, and I think that's an interesting kind of situation you might find out that if you make it so permissible and all the rules are kind of changed or whatever, then what might be the work that might come out of that?
Always the anxiety.
Can I just ask all the people who've mentioned things that they're doing in relation to this topic, can you please put some links on the website so that anybody coming, anybody who wants to follow up afterwards, and anybody coming to the site fresh with an interest in the topic, can connect to what you're saying, please?
Can I just use that as an opportunity to say, shall we close there? Let's close this. We didn't quite get to the publishing, but we'll kind of bring that on. Because that's a very good discussion, and we need to now have a break, and a good break to the archives and talk about ourselves. But I did want to ask Nicola if she would like to say something a bit more about the website, and then I want to thank Duncan, isn't there, for Duncan White's blog. Because Duncan, whose work is a lot around narrative and narrativity and film and video at the moment, has been writing the blog and putting it up as we've been talking and trying to translate it. It's been very interesting keeping to it and looking at it. But it's been really productive over the last day, this idea of the kind of virtual space that we might evolve. And I just wanted to let Nicola have a chance to say how, if you want to engage in it today, in the next couple of hours, how you might do that.
Well, what I thought I might do, Tina's not here today, he was here yesterday, but I think a lot of people have kind of gone, oh, that looks interesting, but haven't bothered to go in and actually look at how he might make a contribution. So maybe, I'm not quite up to date with the schedule, but maybe we could have a look on the whiteboard or the projection board together, or whoever's interested, at a certain point.
Well, let's just break and then take that over there and do that and have that available.
Yeah, so if anybody's interested, we can sit and look at it and then deal with some specific things. I know we've had a few people who want to post comments, but with no identity. So we'll work out a way that you can discreetly put anything you want up there without having any accountability to it.
Into
Thank you.